Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange. We always appreciate your time and attention and invite you to join our conversation here at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. It can be fun to watch our younger relatives and our friends' kids grow up by keeping tabs on Facebook and other social media. Then again, those pictures mean much of the world can now see the faces and glimpses of the lives of the people in them. Anonymity? What's that? The digital trails include much more than social media, though. Leah Plunkett explores the creation of those digital trails for children in her book, Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Leah Plunkett is a parent herself, but also Associate Dean for Administration, Associate Professor of Legal Skills and Director of Academic Success at the University of New Hampshire Law School. She's also faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Leah Plunkett, thanks for joining us.
Wonderful to be here.
You force us to think about situations we know, like the friend's child I first saw on Facebook and sonograms. So this is fairly typical, it sounds like.
Extremely. We really have seen social media become the way of sharing our most intimate updates, from the first baby picture to the even pre-birth picture, as you just said, with sonogram pictures and other rites of passage going out on social before they go out, if they ever go out, in a more brick-and-mortar form.
That's interesting. You say if they ever go out. I just realized that I was sending off, they were late, obviously, Christmas letters yesterday, and thinking, why am I doing this? I could just send PDFs.
It's so funny you should mention that. And look, I don't think a New Year's letter or a holiday season's greetings letter is late until you hit Valentine's Day. So you've got some time in my book.
Appreciate that.
But what I do think that using a holiday card rule of thumb when it comes to our digital postings can be a wonderful hack, if you will, to ensuring that what we're putting out into the world protects our kids' privacy and their ability to develop their own reputations and sense of self. And what I mean by that is, if you are willing to spend the time and money, and if you're anything like me, and I'm not very design savvy, there's always some aggravation. So if you have a piece of information and you would be willing to put it on one of these nice old-fashioned holiday newsletter updates, then it's probably okay to put it on social because you're willing to send it to everyone from your great aunt to your boss. But if a piece of information fails that holiday card rule of thumb, at first pass, probably best to keep it off your social media posts.
Huh, okay, good rule of thumb. So you introduced the concepts, Leah, with Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, or more accurately, with Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer's Aunt Polly. Why choose that avenue?
Because Tom Sawyer encapsulates the spirit of youthful mischief, the rascal with a heart of gold who gets into trouble but means well. And I use Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, not because Tom Sawyer represents every child today in so many ways, he does not, nor should he, based on the era in which he was written, but he encapsulates this myth, if you will, of the more frontier-spirited childhood. And what I say in the book is that if Tom Sawyer were real and he were alive today, he would be busted by the police for what he does in the first chapter of the book. He sneaks out of his guardian's house. He beats up the new kid in town. And Aunt Polly, his guardian, would likely be supplying exhibits A through Z in the case against him by what she puts on social media. And I think that vignette of today's Tom Sawyer being ratted out by his aunt is a way of conveying for people, gosh, we have come a long way from an ideal of childhood as a place of a personal frontier.
Well, so the book puts out a play-centered theory. I mean, essentially have fun as a kid. I mean, this is not a view prevalent in the legal system, it sounds like.
It is not, but the legal system traditionally supports it structurally more than it may first appear. So you are right that my play-based theory of childhood is not the dominant one, but traditionally, so really kind of going back to the 19th century when we started to recognize juvenile justice system as being fundamentally about rehabilitation and not about punishment, the legal system does treat minors differently than adults in almost all instances. And while the legal system doesn't tend to have a great sense of humor for kids or for any of us, at least more traditionally, kids were given second chances. Still today, legal proceedings involving juveniles need to be kept confidential in almost all circumstances. But you're right that what has happened, especially in recent years, is we've seen the rapid growth of a school-to-prison pipeline that especially hits students of color and other minority populations of students disproportionately and penalizes them using the legal system for either mischief or mistakes, but still mistakes that are pretty well within the range of normal youth experimentation.
All right, so what parents do when they're putting their kids' stuff out there is legal. That is right, isn't it?
Yes, outside of very outer limits imposed by criminal laws or other laws of general applicability, sharenting is legal. And I'm not trying to be an annoying law professor there. There are some, sadly, pretty high-profile examples of parents engaged in sharenting where it was not legal, but the illegality came not from putting it online, but from what behaviors were included in the online content. So a few years back, the Washington Post and other national outlets covered a YouTube channel called Daddy05 pretty extensively. And this YouTube channel was a family prank channel, self-proclaimed. But tragically, the pranks really shaded over into the abuse and neglect type of behaviors. And so that family was engaged in illegal sharenting, not because they put it online, but because of what they were doing to their kids in their home and then filming.
Oh, okay. So what it was that they were, the content they were creating using their kids is what got them in trouble.
Correct.
Sharenthood is the book, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Leah Plunkett from the University of New Hampshire School of Law is our guest and its author. We'll come back and talk more with Leah and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-838-3760 by phone. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. So when I asked about what most parents do is legal, and you said generally, yeah, there's a real far edge here that few people have crossed. But now how about social media providers? Is what they do completely legal? And I guess the more appropriate question, Leah, is if there was more robust regulation of digital data, would your book be necessary?
If there was more robust regulation of digital data, my book would be necessary, but it would have a different focus. So a big part of what I'm writing about in Sharenthood is the fact that we as parents, and again, I'm a mom of two young kids. I wrote this book not because I think I have all the answers, but because I have so many questions, I wanted to talk to folks about them. So there are things that we as parents will always need to think about in terms of our own actions and take responsibility for what we do with our kids' stories, with whom we share them. But a big part of what worries me and what Sharenthood talks about is the fact that we as parents, no matter how closely we may try to read those privacy policies and terms of use before we click I consent or I accept and start using a new social media service or start using a smartwatch on our child or anything like that, it is essentially impossible, even for a law nerd like me, to get our heads around what we're agreeing to. And even if we read all the fine print, inevitably there is language in there where the tech company reserves the right to use the information for marketing or to improve the user experience or to share with their affiliates. And language like that creates spaces so big you could drive a truck through them for our kids' private information that we sharent, that we put out there to be aggregated, analyzed, acted upon, and reshared past the tech company that we think we're sharing it with, both now and in the future, and used to make decisions about major life events for our kids really in perpetuity. If we had better legal regulation of social media and other digital products and services that would restrict the ability of the tech vendors themselves to act in ways that we as parents can't know and can't control. So aggregating, analyzing, sharing, and acting upon that data, then what the harm that we might cause from sharenting is likely to be more limited than creating this almost kind of zombie information about our kids that's out there in perpetuity. So better regulation would help a heck of a lot, but there will always be a need for parents in particular, but also grandparents, teachers, and other trusted adults to be mindful of what our own individual choices do in terms of our kids' lives.
It is a vast universe, obviously, and it goes well beyond social media. I was sitting here thinking about all the different places I have accounts, you know, and the times I've clicked on, you know, do you accept the terms? And, I do. And you know, how many places have information on me because of those accounts? And as you begin to build those for your kids, all kinds of things come out. Now, as you track in the book, The Imaginary Tommy, yes, you use Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer. There's a mix of what's real and what might be available to kids and parents in the future. But stuff like socks that track the kids' sleep, that's real?
Yes. So the smart baby booties is real. There's a smart diaper that's real. There are already a lot of sensor-enabled products that are real. Absolutely.
Wow. And the information on them goes not just to mommy and daddy, or does it?
I don't believe that information from a sensor-enabled smart product like that can be trusted to stay with mommy and daddy. Now, I do want to be very clear. I have certainly not even attempted to do a review of every single piece of fine print for every single smart product available for families out there. So if there are sensor-enabled or other types of smart products that are being sold to families that are truly locked down when it comes to privacy, I would love to know about them, because I think that's a huge part of the solution space here. There's a huge market for companies that want to provide services where the information truly is just going to mommy and daddy and maybe on the servers of the company. But I don't have reason to be confident that we're in a place where that is the norm by any stretch.
So let's talk about that. I mean, so this again is well beyond social media. If you have some product that you've registered, or you know, you get data back, or maybe it tells you when your kid needs a diaper change or something. But what often happens, and I'm granted there's no 100% of anything here, but what often happens in any information that ends up on that company's server?
There are so many different things that can happen, and you're right, it's not one size fits all. But the things that Sharenthood focuses on have, in terms of the data resharing and further action, have to do with the realm of data brokers. So there are companies out there that function as sort of a part of the family tree, if you will, since we're talking about families, with credit reporting agencies, with credit bureaus. But instead of just aggregating consumer credit information, they are aggregating vast amounts of intimate information across all categories. And we know that these data brokers then make these lists, or selects, a subset of lists, available for purchase by a range of institutions. And we also do know that these data brokers, which are very lightly regulated, if at all, are including information about very, very young kids. A recent study by the Center on Law and Information Policy at Fordham Law School found in a representative sample of, I think, roughly 14 data brokers that there was information in there about kids as young as 2 years old. And so once that information that is extracted, maybe not directly from any one particular digital product, but from digital products and services more generally, that information can then make its way out into the hands of many other institutions without the parents ever seeing, let alone consenting.
Leah Plunkett is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a lawyer and parent and law professor. Her book is Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. But again, it's not just us talking about our kids online. We could choose to go, you know, totally Luddite at home and not even have anything that collects any data. But as you point out, in school, there's all kinds of ed tech that collects stuff too.
Absolutely. And schools, if they are complying with applicable state and federal privacy laws and regulations, are actually more privacy-protecting environments often than homes are. Now, I say if they are complying, not because I don't trust educators. I am an educator, and as Associate Dean for Administration, I certainly take our students' privacy very seriously. But I say if because the student privacy legal and regulatory frameworks that exist are often hard for teachers or frontline administrators to follow. And so if you have an individual school or a school district or a state that has invested in multi-stakeholder teams to vet ed tech, educational technologies, and such a team would ideally involve, you know, the law perspective, the technology perspective, in addition to the educator perspective, then you can wind up with school systems like the Cambridge Public School System in Massachusetts, for instance, where they have really done their homework on privacy. And so because of their access to multi-stakeholder experts, they can make, I think, on the whole, much better decisions about children's privacy in the classroom than most parents are in a position to make in the home. Not that parents don't want to, but they simply don't have the resources or the bandwidth to figure it all out themselves.
You suggest later in the book, Leah, that educational technology can enhance equity in education. Can you explore that concept?
Ideally, ed tech could move us to a place where we are opening up opportunities to kids who might not otherwise have them. And there are a few ways that you can see this happening. One would be at the classroom level. If you have an overcrowded classroom with not enough teachers, if you are able to individualize or personalize learning through a digital product or service, then students can learn at different speeds, at different levels, simultaneously, rather than being limited by what the teacher can teach to the whole class. Also, if you are using data-driven decision-making in a non-biased way, ideally, you'd be in a position to identify kids with talents and capacities that can be developed that might not otherwise get noticed because of the limitations of human bias, often unconscious. I'm not super optimistic because I think there's a lot of research and just experience out there that suggests that as we're building artificial intelligence and other digital systems, we're probably building in our bias more often than not. But I am fundamentally a glasses half full type of person. So let's hope that the optimistic part of that glass wins the day.
Sharon Hood, again, is the name of the book by Leah Plunkett, subtitled Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. And obviously, this goes way beyond social media. There's all kinds of places that are used to collect data on our kids, some of which does, in fact, end up in the hands of data brokers as young as two, as Leah has pointed out already. Join us on The Exchange if you have some concerns, some questions, some stories to share with us about digital technology and your children. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I remember flinching a little bit in school, finding out that there were so many security cameras on the grounds because they were able to say, oh, you know, yeah, here's what your kid was doing at that time, which, you know, was helpful in some ways and eek in others. But so let me ask a basic question here, Leah. Before the age of 18, do kids get much say about what is collected on them by school, by parents, by anyone?
Not much. Interestingly, California just had their new Consumer Privacy Act go into effect earlier this month. And the Consumer Privacy Act out in California is opening up a certain realm where kids between the ages of 13 and 16 themselves would have to give consent for a business, certain types of business, to sell personal information about them. But that's California, although it will be quite impactful nationwide. But even a situation like that where you have a requirement of the child himself, herself, or themselves giving consent for the sale of their personal information, that is about information that is coming from them about them. The California Consumer Privacy Act does not appear here to be giving kids any type of veto power or even control over what their parents might sharent about them. And certainly at the federal level, and the dominant approach nationwide would be that parents get to decide, unless they are bumping up against those criminal laws or laws of general applicability, so laws that bind all of us, not just in our capacity as sharents, that parents get to decide whether, when, how, why, and with whom to sharent.
Well, let me ask an even broader question then. I mean, how clear is the set of rights that we possess as adults to know what is stored, by whom, and to do something about having it removed? And I know Europe has put some law down on this case, but it sounds like the United States is, other than California, is rather slow.
The United States is rather slow. We have the ability as adults to avail ourselves of any recourse that an individual tech company has provided to us. So somewhere buried in all those terms and conditions and privacy policies that we are clicking on would be the way that an individual company is saying, if we have information that you want to request removal of, let us know. Many companies will also offer you access to determining what information they have about you. Similarly, data brokers typically, if you can track down all the ones that are out there, there's no one-stop shopping for them the way there is for our credit reporting agencies, our credit bureaus, through annualcreditreport.gov. You can, pursuant to that broker's individual policies and terms of use, make a request to access and request addition or modification of the information they have about you, but it is clunky, it is cumbersome, there is not a lot of enforcement or oversight. And so on the whole, speaking now on sort of a nationwide overview, we, even as adults, are kind of on our own when it comes to somebody posting something about us that we don't want to see on social media.
Wow. So then, outside this realm again, to back to the imaginary Tom Sawyer that you're following in the book, and juvenile records. These are supposed to be expunged at some point, aren't they?
They are.
But are you finding that that in the digital world they're slow to be expunged?
There's a great law review article called Databasing Delinquency, which found that there were a number of ways that the confidentiality requirements for juvenile records, for juvenile involvement with the criminal justice system, was not as locked down as it was supposed to be, and that information regarding juvenile misconduct or criminal system involvement was finding its way into a range of databases that could be used for a range of purposes both now and in the future. So, sorry, that is a long law professor answer to your question. The short answer to your question is yes, we are finding that in the digital era it is getting harder to lock down juvenile records.
All right, we start turning green when you write in the book about the potential for kid pics to be used for child pornography. Talk about the mismatch you find between anti-pornography laws and digital behavior.
We are putting so many intimate moments online, and by intimate, I don't mean pornographic or abusive. I mean something that is at heart as innocent as, you know, the baby in the bathtub, right? Mm-hmm. But to build on the baby in the bathtub and use it in a more metaphorical way, when we get as comfortable as we've gotten with posting pictures of our kids on the beach, in a bathtub, or in any state of undress, we are unfortunately throwing out the proverbial baby with the proverbial bathwater a little bit when it comes to keeping our children safe, because we do know that, tragically, a significant number of the images of child abuse, of pornographic images that are out there, are images of real children that are taken and retouched to turn them into objects of abuse rather than these innocent memories.
Yikes. I can remember my brother getting annoyed when my father would show the slide of him in the bathtub as a 2-year-old, and that was just with the immediate family. I could just imagine that picture ending up on Facebook in today's world.
You have captured perfectly the transition from the brick-and-mortar era, which I also grew up in. I'm at the tail end of Gen X, to today's born digital, to use Urs Gasser and John Palfrey's term from their wonderful book, where that picture is not just the stuff of a private family viewing, but it's really open to the world, no matter what your privacy settings are.
All right. It is no longer just a slideshow off the dining room table after dinner. The book is called Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Leah Plunkett, law professor and parent herself, is our guide through this book. You can join us on the exchange by phone and email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Leah Plunkett and you in a minute 25. I meant to ask you earlier, I've noticed some people, I'm not sure this is a strategy or just forgetfulness, but they'll put pictures of their kids up, but they never tag them and never even write their names. Is that a strategy?
I do think that is a strategy. I'm not sure how much it helps. Certainly it helps some because you're limiting the information. But we do know that, of course, a picture that's up there can be seen not just by the people that you may have put your social media settings on to allow in, but it can be downloaded or screenshotted and then uploaded by people who have it and shared really endlessly. So while there's a certain amount of privacy protection gloss, if you will, that can come from not putting names and not tagging, I think it is a light dusting rather than a strong fix.
Okay, but the idea, though, about pictures in particular, I mean, you know, there's a greater sense over time, I think, of the horse being completely out of the barn, particularly like we had the recent situation with a member of Congress tweeting a Photoshop picture of President Obama with the Iranian president who he never met. I mean, So you get to the point where some people say, what's the point of controlling our images and our info when somebody's going to muck with them anyway?
That is a very valid and very hard question, particularly as we move to a time when Photoshop seems quaint, as we start thinking about deep fakes and the ability to create whole alternate versions of reality. My response is that now more than ever, we need to double down on our privacy because the proper response to the assault, if you will, on privacy is not to abdicate the fight, but to come up with new and better and more ways of trying to make sure that, especially when it comes to our kids, for whom we have a heightened legal, moral, and just practical obligation to be mindful of the fact that they have so much learning, so much playing, to go back to my theory of childhood, and so much self-discovery to do, that if there is anything we can do to try to protect their ability to do it, we should, even if it's a light dusting.
Right. And to what you're talking about here, you really get right down, Leah, to the very sense of self. I mean, how do you see the digital data trail interfering with the development of the self in kids?
In a couple of ways. One would be at the level of actual experience. So you were talking before the break about your brother used to get upset with the screening of the two-year-old bathtub photo from the, around the family dining room table. Well, now imagine that your brother, grows up and finds that people that he's meeting for the first time as a 12-year-old or 22-year-old can say, oh, yeah, I watched you grow up through your family's pictures. That just interferes with your ability to introduce yourself to somebody at whatever life stage you're at without them knowing more things about you. Now, of course, there are going to be many people you meet who did not know your parents and have not seen digital images of you. But you also now, as a child trying to develop a sense of your own identity, are going to be impacted and in some cases likely limited by ways that key decision makers, whether those are educational institutions or employers or insurance providers or other gatekeepers, have gotten their hands on and relied upon digital data about you in terms of how they're going to treat you. And you may never know. So on the one hand, I guess that makes it a little better. On the other hand, that makes it worse because it can create this sense of it's not paranoia if they're actually watching you.
Well, as you point out, I mean, colleges, potential employers look at social media. You have stories here of college roommates who've looked at the social media of the people they're just meeting as their roommates, that kind of stuff. But you also get into stuff like identity theft of kids. And so Sharenting contributes to that as well. I mean, what are people doing with kids' identities?
Kids' identities are unfortunately a major and appealing target for identity thieves and other criminal actors because there are very few legitimate reasons why a child's social security number would have credit activity tied to it. There are some, but they're not that many. Children typically are not getting credit cards, taking out mortgages, or doing all of those other daily financial interactions that we do as adults. And so for an identity thief to get their hands on an unvarnished social security number and add that to the other pieces of identifying information that they may be able to get either through, you know, sort of the dark web through a data breach or for kids in particular, through a parent's social media posting about celebrating the birthday of John Timothy Stewart Smith, who turned 8 years old on January 1st, 2020. And there's a picture of little Johnny in front of his home with the address showing. You know, it's gotten so bad that there are law enforcement agencies, the Utah Attorney General's Office comes to mind, that have specific divisions or bureaus on children's identity theft, special folks dedicated to it, because it is already a big problem and likely to get worse.
Are we talking hundreds of cases a year, thousands of cases a year in Utah, for example?
I don't know what the exact numbers are for Utah. I do know that Barclays Bank had a study out within the last year that was putting a numerical value on the likely cost of Sharenting-based kids' identity theft, not just now but going forward, because of the fact that it will kind of go on over time. And I believe what Barclays was saying is that, it was about a year ago, they were saying that it could annually cost the future generation of kids, I'm reading from a news report now, they were saying close to $700 million by 2030.
Wow, that is a bunch. So suppose a parent decides, okay, that's it. No social media, no online, nothing. You know, I'm going to make sure I do not give permission in school when it is requested for certain things. On down the line. Now, flip this around, though, because we were just talking about how employers and colleges look at social media presences. Does it send up a red flag in today's world if a child doesn't have one?
Potentially. And it is something that I worry about as I go around talking to folks about this, that you don't want to have your child sort of not exist or exist in a limited format with respect to the digital world. Because you're right, that could send off a sort of strange signal. But where I come down on balance is that there are so many ways that kids' information, all of our information, is picked up in the course of daily life that we will really never even have an awareness of, that there's still going to be some digital data trail for your child no matter what you do. So if you can limit it to avoid the biggest potential for embarrassment or your child's sense of self or future opportunities being shaped by it, I would say tip the balance in favor of privacy protection when you can, because the default setting, to use a tech term here, the default setting of our culture right now is so tipped toward surveillance and sharing in all its forms that you are unlikely to ever really be able to take your child fully off the grid.
All right. So from the parents who would like to take their kids off the grid and it's not always successful, to the concept of commercial sharenting, what is that?
Commercial sharenting refers to ways in which parents monetize or try to monetize their children's private lives for their own business purposes. And there are some spectacularly successful commercial sharents out there. and they include everyone from folks who start as celebrities, so people are interested in them anyway, and then they just kind of start adding their kids to the mix, or folks who are more what I call homegrown commercial Sharons. So the mom who starts posting Instagram pictures of her beautiful meals and her beautiful kids and her perfectly organized playroom and develops a social media following and then becomes a lifestyle influencer. And kids are typically central to those business models. And I do think it's tricky because on the one hand, it's empowering for parents, particularly women, to have outlets to turn their specialty, if you will, in parenting or homemaking into a business opportunity. On the other hand, it is strange that we have essentially a big, largely unregulated realm of child labor happening through sharenting that is done for commercial purposes.
In the sense that they're being actors in their mom's stuff and not getting paid for it, yeah.
That's right. And it's tricky because if you look at federal and state labor laws, commercial sharenting falls into a really, really gray zone. So is it entertainment or is it a family business or is it not even a family business but just a child in their home? And if we film that child eating a bowl of the trendy breakfast cereal and put it on YouTube, is that actually work? I would say it is, because you are commodifying that personal experience the child is having, but the child may not even be aware that it's happening if the child's young. I don't think that takes it out of the work definition, either legally or morally, but it is strange to be asking the question, it's a very, you know, for the moment digital era question, is it work if you don't know you're doing it?
Right. Well, obviously, a lot of concerns that would come to the fore of lawmakers who would have to think about where to go from here. Optimist though you may be, Leah, what do you think when you see like members of Congress not really understand how Facebook makes money?
I think that all of us need to be looking for a multi-stakeholder solution space. I am a lawyer. I am a law teacher. I have tremendous faith in the ability of our rule of law system to provide safeguards in sharenting and other areas of tech. I don't think at the federal level in particular that has been happening in a very robust and meaningful way. So all the more reason that those of us who are parents who care about privacy should be asking tech companies to provide us with locked down, parent-proof, if you will, privacy-protecting products. Or looking to our state lawmakers and regulators, like folks did in California, and saying, hey, you know, the horse is out of the barn, but can we still save the chickens?
So what are the do's here? I mean, how let a kid have a childhood with lots of playtime, as you advocate, but especially when playtime for kids often means, you know, a tablet or a phone or some other digital device?
I think that if you as a parent can have a values-based approach to sharenting and be mindful of it, that can go a long way. And what I mean by a values-based approach is not complicated. It's saying, in this house, we value privacy, we value play, we value connecting with humans, human to human. And so that means that if our child is playing pretend, we are not going to post that video on YouTube because we value privacy and play more than the type of really attenuated connection you can get from YouTube. So I really encourage, as a big do, all parents, as well as grandparents, educators, coaches, directors, and so on, to just take a couple of minutes, and the new year is a great time for it, and think about the values that you want to have animate your experience with the kids in your life, and then try to make tech choices that are in line with those values.
Is there one thing above all others you would recommend a parent do today that they perhaps didn't do before today?
I would recommend that parents do not use surveillance technologies on their own kids. So the watches that tell you where your child is, the apps that tell you where your child is, I think that puts your kids at risk of hacking, of their whereabouts being tracked by a person in real life who is unknown to you, who may be a bad actor, or someone who is known to you in your broader circle who actually is a bad actor and you don't know that. We do know, tragically, a lot of instances of child abuse and neglect come from within a child's own social network. I also think that serving up information about where your child goes to tech companies who may do goodness knows what with it now and in the future is not a healthy sharenting choice.
All right, a lot to think about here. Leah Plunkett is at the University of New Hampshire School of Law, also a faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Her book is Sharenthood: Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. Leah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care. That will do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. Find us on social media. Oh boy, there we go. Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. The program is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt is at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the day off from rain and have a great day.